Welcome back to the Beyond Broadcast podcast, a show which takes a behind-the-scenes look at industry professionals and their lives working in the broadcasting and entertainment industry. Today, I'm speaking with Tash Christie. At the heart of many of New Zealand's most notable factual programming, it's impossible not to mention the crucial role of local production company Greenstone Television. Tash and the amazing team have been the creative minds in the workforce in series such as Border Patrol, The Zoo, Motorway Patrol, and Neighbours at War, just to name a few, reflecting our culture and identity to the world. Outside of her incredible career in the media, Tash has also managed to balance her life of being a mum of three. Welcome to the show, Tash.
Kia ora, Jamie. Nice to be here.
Such a pleasure to chat to you. And I think the best thing that I've found so far from doing research on you, Tash, and getting to know a little bit more about you from reading interviews and obviously looking at like the background that you've had, your upbringing was pretty nomadic, I guess you could say, like 9 schools in 9 years, living in places like Fiji, London, Melbourne. So like for you in those early years, because a lot of people talk about the difficulty of things like changing schools, even when you're living in the same city, how did you find it like adapting to changing locations so like constantly almost at that young age?
I think I cope with it better than my brothers, to be fair. and I think I did because I basically learned all these really amazing techniques, which I think have become my superpowers in my later career as well. I guess I learned to decipher what I needed to do to fit in, and I listened a lot to gauge what was right, what wasn't right, all of those things. So I think even though for a lot of people that would have been traumatizing, I guess it was something within me that I was able to learn and adapt, and that's now become something that I use every day in my career as well.
Did you find that you were almost a mentor to your brothers in that sense?
I think it was a survival thing, but I think I feel lucky for it. Now, reflecting back, I feel lucky. Yeah.
And from memory, I think I read somewhere that you actually had a pretty early start as well in theatre, and that became kind of like a bit of a community for you, and that like it kind of helped through all the changes that you were going through. And was that kind of the start of like your love for like the arts and entertainment, or was it something that kind of developed later in life, or was theatre like the sticking point where you began?
I think you've nailed it, because I think when I finally did settle down and I went to Wellington Girls College and I found a cohort of fellow thespians, and I think that did build suddenly a community for me. And that was where, I mean, I didn't come from a theatrical family or background at all, so for me it was my own thing, and I love a theatre. I mean, you're just putting it out there, right? And it's actually the hardest creative profession, I think, because you are out there raw on stage and it's on you. You've got no backup really. So I loved it, but what I did do, so I went to Victoria Uni and did my theatre studies degree, which I adored as well. Did it with very awesome people like Robin Malcolm and Katie Wolfe and lots of Tim Balm. So all the OGs. I realized when I did that I was never going to be on stage, because it's just not my happy place. So I kind of went down the costume design route, but it was still very much I was at the center of a community that I felt I could do something within, which was cool. It was really cool.
Do you feel like there's something a little bit addictive as well about being in that space with having so much energy and motivation and people with like such a like kind of natural sort of glow? Was it kind of something that you're like, the longer I stay in this space, the more I kind of learn and gravitate to these kind of people?
Yeah, and it was really cool. It was sort of the late 80s in Wellington, and so you had Bats Theatre had just started up, and people were taking risks. You know, we literally, I think for about a year and a half, I made no money. I spent more money on costumes making them than I ever made, because it was co-op theatre. So everyone just, you know, put everything in a pot and made it work. But absolutely, it is, there's a happy place and an adrenaline rush and all of the things when you just have to do it on your own. And I think it also builds the resilience for people too. So I think theatre as a starting point for me was really, really good. And I look back on it very, very fondly and sometimes miss it, actually. The live thing is really awesome.
And you mentioned co-op as well. So that's kind of like, I feel like an endearing thing for anyone from New Zealand is there's like an element of this sort of like DIY approach that kind of seems to run true. And even at like the professional level, it's still like a thing of kind of like get stuck in, make it work kind of thing. And do you think that was kind of like a really good building block for you going into television production eventually, like being able to make things work on a tight budget, especially as you said, you were losing more money than like making money on costumes. So it's kind of like you have to be a little bit industrious.
Yeah, 100%. And look, I mean, that's the thing, especially with factual and unscripted, where you literally are going with the flow. You never know what's going to happen at any point. You know, you can plan your documentary as much as you want, but something's going to happen halfway through, at the beginning, at the end, that just completely changes the landscape. And yes, I do think, Jamie, that having those early days, what it gave me is the ability not to panic. I don't panic. There's no point in panicking. You know, you just have to take a deep breath and go, okay, well, let's try something different, or let's go this path, or let's do this. And so, yeah, actually, I've never thought about that, but you're probably right. It was, by the seat of your pants style that we still use. Yeah.
And I think this is kind of like the stage that everyone goes through where we're kind of bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, kind of like deer in the headlights, where we want the exciting thing, where we're the creators, we're everything else. But sometimes we do realize we have to, at some point, kind of make a bit of dough on the side. And you kind of moved into marketing as well, didn't you, very early on in your career, marketing and advertising. How was it for you moving into that space compared to theatre, where it's obviously a lot more kind of free and where marketing and advertising is a lot more rigid? How did you find kind of transitioning into that?
Well, I was super lucky, I think, in a way, because I decided with my theatre hat on I wanted to travel. And so I joined Camp Counselors USA. So I went and did that. And that was with my drama hat on. So I was the drama teacher for these crazy young American kids. And then loved California so much because it was so different to, you know, Wellington, Pōneke, New Zealand. So wanted to stay. I ended up staying in LA. And I probably shouldn't say this out loud, but I did work illegally for a while. Well, no, I was sort of volunteering at a local.
Probably can't mention it now. Probably can't do it now, but yeah.
No, I would never do it now. My God, such a different world. But I was working for a musical theatre company behind the scenes, making costumes for the theatre company because I really wanted to stay in LA. I was just, it was so exciting and so cool. So I worked with all the Mexican women and I worked illegally and had to occasionally rush off to the toilets while immigration did their little rounds. But eventually, obviously after about 6 months, for somebody who's a bit of a nerd and a goody-good, I actually couldn't do that for long. It was too stressful. So I knocked on the door, and this again is the late 80s, early 90s, so it's a different time. I knocked on the door of the Tourism Board, New Zealand Tourism Board, which is what Tourism New Zealand was called in those days, knocked on the door and said, have you got a job? And they said, yes, we do. And so it was crazy. And so I literally spent 6 months on the telephone because people used to phone up for information. That's how long ago it was. So there was no internet, really. And we'd have these Americans phone us going, now, tell us about the bridge from Australia to New Zealand. How long does that take? And blah, blah, blah. So I was literally an information officer on the phones telling Americans what to expect when they got to New Zealand. So that was my very first job in marketing, but it was really good because you kind of had to describe things in a marketing way. We were trying to, you know, market the country and make them feel comfortable about coming and all the rest of it. Eventually, obviously, I stepped up a little bit and turned out, you know, I was with marketing and incentives, and that was the perfect job for me because I could live in LA, but I would be sent home occasionally to, you know, reacquaint myself with New Zealand, Aotearoa, and what we were doing there and all the rest of it. So yeah, that was cool. And then obviously when I came back, it gave me a chance to actually earn money as well, which was cool. So it was a good part of my life. And actually, I think because I come from my father was very much a marketing business guru, so it didn't feel uncomfortable for me melding the two. So melding the creative with the more business end actually felt really comfortable. And I feel lucky that I was able to incorporate both of those things in my career going forward. So, yeah. Yeah.
And you're in a place that's quite big for television and film as well, LA being like the powerhouse of like Hollywood and everything else. Was there any sort of hints of like you moving into television even at that point, or was it still something that wasn't really crossing your mind? You were still kind of focusing on the marketing, kind of sticking around that sort of space and just seeing where the kind of tide took you? Or was it kind of like that was like the early point where you're like, I maybe should like have a look at this. This seems interesting.
That's really, I actually never thought about it, I don't think. I don't think I did. I mean, what it did give me is a sense of a wider community, you know, different voices, different cultures, different, much more than you would ever have got in Wellington in the 80s, you know. So I think for me, that was the exciting thing, is realizing there's a whole world out there and a whole bunch of people who think really differently to you. I think that was probably the sparking point. I'd always vaguely thought about TV. I think when I needed to tell you the story because I suddenly thought about it when you initially reached out. I think I got a little obsessed with TV when my mum won a colour TV in one of the few shows that was on television at the time, It's in the Bag with Selwyn Toogood.
Oh,
I mean, most of your listeners are too young to even remember it, but it was like one of the few game shows, local game shows. And my mum and dad both went in as participants. And my mum won the colour TV. And we were the only household in the neighbourhood that had a colour TV. And so it was like, okay, maybe TV was a part of my life from that very early stage. And then I just kind of maybe was, I don't know, drawn to it. But in LA, to be fair, it was more about the excitement of being with a whole bunch of different people that I think when I did end up coming home, I needed something a bit bigger, a bit more that could reach out a bit more maybe. I don't know. That's my initial thoughts on that.
But the interesting thing is you're already at this point, obviously now in your career is all about telling stories from New Zealand, explaining the culture of New Zealand in a way that's interesting and can kind of be approached from an international standpoint. And you were doing that already on fairly early days over the phone, just using your voice. Like, is it kind of weird to think about now that you're basically doing the same thing at a much larger scale?
You know what? That is really weird. I've never thought about it like that. But yeah, I guess so. I mean, it was sort of just a needs thing. I needed a job and I got it. But yeah, I think so. I mean, obviously, I'm behind the scenes and I'm not a great translator. So I work now with people who are those people, those directors, those writers, those people who actually. But what I do have, I think, is the ability to connect all those people and to listen and have those conversations and build that trust. And I think that's exactly what you're talking about. Those phone calls where you don't even know who that person is, you immediately have to find the warmth or the connecting point or the thing you've got in common. And I think finding that thing you have in common, especially in this day and age of culture wars and rabbit holes and lots of anger, being able to both listen but also convince of the different perspective, I think is going to become more and more important, you know, even more so than it has been. So, yeah.
Would you say some of the most successful people that you've seen in the industry have been very similar to you in the sense of they've always been connectors? Because I think what I've noticed over the years is that sometimes some of the people that don't actually have the best technical skills are actually sometimes the best people at working in the industry because they're so good at building teams around them that can build, like, basically create things from having such a wide variety of, I should probably reword this. Essentially, you're finding the right people at all times because you know what can be filled out and you just have built all these friendships and networks over time. Do you feel like that's something that you've continued on and you continue to see now in the industry, like people just being really good connectors?
Yeah. It's all about that. It's absolutely all about that. And especially in the unscripted world, it's not about you at all. And if you go into making a doco or a factual series and you think it's about you, then you're going to fail because it is about the people you have around you and about, yes, those connections that you've made in the past, but also trusting enough to bring new people on board. I mean, the one thing I do have, and in fact, all of the leadership team at Greenstone, we have this, and it's not unusual, but we do have a no dickheads policy, and it really is important. As soon as you get a whiff of somebody on a team that's just not collaborative and not there for the betterment of the project, just cut it loose. It's not worth it because it's too hard. It's too hard to get the funding. It's too hard to get something off the ground. And also it's too risky because in unscripted, you're relying on that trust with the people who are contributing, with the storytellers, with everybody. If you don't have that trust, you may as well forget it.
And essentially, it's my honest opinion. Yeah, and essentially, you're already in a stressful situation as it is, so you don't want to make it more stressful, which I think leads into a pretty like interesting kind of segue for the fact that you and your husband, Dan, ended up founding our Octopus Pictures in the 2000s, which is probably finding the most trustworthy person, your husband, then in the future, which is pretty funny, and you became like co-captains together. Was it interesting moving that kind of personal to professional sort of like bridge, like making that personal professional bridge with your husband? And how has it been over the years being able to work with your husband? That's like a pretty unusual thing for anyone in the industry to be able to work with their partner so closely.
I know. Well, yeah, really good question. How long have you got? No, just joking. But is this a therapy session? But no. Well, it's really funny because Dan and I met at university. So when I came back from LA, I decided to do my broadcasting diploma. And we were so lucky in those days, there were only 6 people on the course. So it was pretty hands-on and pretty amazing. So met Dan doing that study period. And to be fair, I thought he was such an idealist. He had specific opinions, very idealistic. But we realized that together, we actually worked. So we are quite different personalities. And I think that's why our business relationship has worked. We have different skill sets. I'm very much the producer person. I can look at things with creative eyes after the fact, but I'm not really the person to initiate things. So, you know, I'm better with money, all of those. Sorry, Dan. But I think it did work really well from that perspective. It was also partly a survival thing for us because, you know, we were 2 young people trying to make our way in an industry where you are a contractor the whole time. I mean, I'm not at the moment, but that's been the first time in my entire career. So we both had short-term contracts on projects that we didn't know were going to happen or not. We were having to put a lot of time and effort into developing projects. As 2 young parents, we didn't know whether we would be able to pay our mortgage or not. And all of those, that uncertainty that everybody goes through in this industry, but we doubled it down, which was maybe stupid. Now I think back on it, I go, what were we thinking? But in some ways it was perfect because we knew the parameters, we knew the risks, and we could help each other out with those things. It did have some gnarly points where we were literally working outside, out of our bedroom, and because we had no other space in the house because there were babies and toddlers and things, and we were literally working in our bedroom, and our lovely production manager at the time had to work out of our bedroom too, and it just wasn't great. And you know, Karen used to go, oh, they're like, oh, where are you working? Oh, in Tash and Dan's bedroom. It wasn't ideal, and it wasn't a big bedroom, can I just say that much? But hey, we made it work, and we're still working in the industry, and I feel so grateful. I think all of those building blocks and risks and experiences help. You know, it's never a straight line with this industry, or any creative industry, actually. It's squiggly as fuck. But if you can squiggle and just make it work, then it's perfect, I think. Yeah, very grateful.
And you also have the element of the yin and yang. As you said, your husband's an idealist and you're like the pragmatist. You're very pragmatic and you're like, no, this can't be done, this can be done. Do you feel like that like kind of has always been a great dynamic for you both, because he challenges you in the way to kind of open your eyes to something else, but you manage to rein him in when maybe your project's getting a bit too ridiculous? What would you say has been the best example of that on both ends, where you've had to rein him in, but on the other end, he's told you, you know what, Tash, we need to be a little bit more liberal, maybe spend a little bit more money to make some money, you know? What were the best examples for you of the last few years?
Oh, my goodness. Well, we haven't actually made anything together for a while now, because we've both just been, I guess, we've had, you come from babies to teenagers, and then they're really expensive. So we kind of both had to kind of get jobs with other companies. But I think some of the things, if I think back on the projects we've done together, the Pictures of Susan, which was a film doco, which we haven't done a lot of film docos, Dan and I. We've primarily been smaller platforms, smaller screen. But that was amazing. That was a connection Dan had with a family and a mute artist. And that was really good because it's not something I necessarily would have gone into myself. But Dan felt he knew there was a story there, and it's still playing around the world. It's amazing. I mean, people just connect with both her art, which is very outsider art style, but the story itself was so intimate and so special that I just am so grateful that we went there, because I think the world is a lesser place without that story being told. And I think that was a moment for me realizing that this is something we need to do. I think the other funny story is when Dan, we were at uni, Dan went off on the peace flotilla, the anti-nuclear peace flotilla, and he took the university cameras with him to film and document a whole bunch of interviews and things, and with the people who were on the flotilla. And I was like, oh, so you're an idealist, but you actually do shit as well. That's kind of cool. And I think at that moment too, it made me realize you can be an idealist, but if you make things happen, that's brilliant. You know, the power of that is everything. So I think for me, that made me fall in love with him, obviously, and made me think he was a good guy. I'm trying to think of some of the other early things that we did. Oh, my God. Sorry, Menno Brain. It's really bad.
Did it also have an element of, like, rebellion as well, the sense that he was willing to kind of go, like, to maybe places or cover topics that necessarily most other people wouldn't take? Like you said, Pictures of Susan, as you said, probably is not a traditional story. It would be hard to tell. You're really relying on kind of the network of people around Susan rather than necessarily her as a subject herself. Like, do you think that was kind of like an element of what, like, made you gravitate to him, is like the understanding that he's probably willing to take a few more risks than most people?
Yeah, I think so, definitely. Because I was always playing it a little bit safer. You know, yes, quietly in the background doing things, possibly pushing buttons a little bit more. But yeah, Dan was prepared to just step up and be that guy and push other people to have their opinions and speak to other people and try and convince people of things. So yeah, Dan is kind of the activist side of our relationship, and it actually works quite well because I guess I'm more the empath and he's more the activist. So between us, we can actually create stuff that talks to lots of people. Yeah.
That's really cool. And I think one of the other interesting things I found about your career is the fact that it seems like everything that you've done has been about representing New Zealand in one way or another. And that includes your work with Film Auckland, where you're like obviously promoting the viability of making films and television in Auckland. And now obviously New Zealand is still seen for the most part as a beautiful location to film. I know it's getting more expensive for a lot of people, and that's why there's been a little bit of a downturn. But at that time, how was it for you trying to, like, convince people, New Zealand, great place to film? Obviously, when Lord of the Rings came out, everyone was flocking to it. But at that time, I'm guessing it was still kind of a rarity for any production to come to New Zealand to film.
Yeah, it was. And it was a really cool time, actually, because that was, the board was a whole bunch of industry sort of champions, I guess, who were giving up their time to try and make it happen, because they realised at the time that the industry needed to have, it was either feast or famine, and there wasn't enough funding locally to be able to have the infrastructure and the studios and things like that that would mean there was some sustainability going forward for the industry in Auckland. A lot of it was happening in Wellington, like you say, in Pōneke with Lord of the Rings, and I think we realised a lot of the crew were here in Tamaki, but it just was, we realised we needed a bigger piece of the pie, and I feel grateful that that collective group managed to sort of make that happen. I mean, I think it's a slightly different thing now because people do know that we have incredible talent and incredible infrastructure, and obviously the locations speak for themselves. But at that time, nobody knew that New Zealand could even pick up a camera. You know, it was really embarrassing, actually, you know, that we were actually having to say, hey, we know how to do things and we do them even better than you guys because we have half the budgets. And, you know, our people are multi-skilled. Like, you're not just going to get a sounder. You're going to have someone who can do camera and sound and direct and do all of those things, which, you know, I think the agility and the talent end of things was really important to be stamping our mark on. And I think we've done that really well. Obviously now, I mean, you know, with the screen production rebate now, that's a really important piece of the puzzle right now because it allows us to attract international money, but tell our own stories with that money. But the trust is out there that New Zealand and Aotearoa and our industry know what we're doing. Everyone knows we're brilliant at what we do now. And that's largely due to producers who have travelled the world for years and, you know, talk the talk. But it's also because of the work that we make and the fact that our work travels and it's really freaking good. So, yeah, Film Auckland was cool. And again, it felt like the next step for me, the next stepping stone. It was marketing, but it kind of helped me with my career as well to get a better sense of the wider industry.
I think you touched on something really interesting as well when you talk about the idea of people saying like, oh, we didn't even know people in New Zealand could pick up a camera. But I've also heard that a thing that kind of is kind of touted in New Zealand is the fact that we're not against getting stuck in, and that obviously a lot of people get a bit funny about the idea of saying, oh, you know, without a union, it's a bit dodgy. But because New Zealand doesn't have these intense unions as well, it does mean that people are a little bit more multi-skilled and willing to kind of do things that are a little bit outside of like their general scope. Do you think that's also the reason why a lot more people are coming to New Zealand, because they know that the work ethic is really good, and if they get a crew, they are going to go the extra mile to make sure something looks good, feels good, and is a production that runs smoothly? Do you think that's largely why people are returning?
I think it's primarily that the talent is here. And obviously exchange rate is helpful too. that's really helpful for those international budgets. I think that the labour thing, the union thing, was something for a while. I think now our guilds are really good at, you know, we're not unionized, but our guilds are on top of everything. And, you know, the Directors Guild is fantastic. WIFT are great. SPARTA are great. You know, I think we could have gone down we'll just use and abuse them route. We didn't go down that route. I think our guilds over the years have been able to maintain a strength there, even though we're not unionized. I think things can happen a little, you know. I mean, obviously with COVID and things, that was tricky for the industry in terms of, you know, things shutting down. But I definitely think our attraction is less about the lack of unions and more about the talent base here and the exchange rate. And the screen production rebate, and the screen production rebate too, because that's massive. So yeah,
that totally makes sense. I believe it was actually the same here in Argentina for a number of years that they had a very similar thing. A really good crew, really good equipment, screen rebates, obviously. Odd to think that I think it was only 10 years ago they were saying it was very normal to see Madonna kind of walking through the city centre where I am. And I think 3 years ago there was Robert De Niro. You know, it's all a bit odd, but now it's kind of changed because, yeah, they're not doing as many rebates, which New Zealand seems to be doubling down on it. But I think it's interesting also to shift over to you moving into actually working at Greenstone, where you became a producer and worked on some very, very legendary TV shows. One of my absolute favourites being, and I'm sure it's the one that everyone brings up, but it's because it's such a goodie. Neighbours at War, like bloody hell.
I knew it was going to be that one.
it had to be. I've explained it to my girlfriend so many times, and even now I need to sit her down and like go through the seasons, you know, watch it all. But you've said that it created a space for real conversations you probably wouldn't have ever had. And looking back, do you think that's one of the projects that you're the most proud of? Because it was a scary project. Like, how the hell were you meant to sell that to anyone? Being like, yeah, we're going to film neighbours arguing with each other and see what happens. Like, how did that conversation even happen? And, like, I just need to know everything, Tash, because I feel like it was such a risk.
It was such a risk. And look, to be fair, I can't take credit for that because I came off the back of the series. So did the last two series. But look, anyone who's worked on Neighbours at War, we are a whānau. We call ourselves survivors because we literally, that was skin of your teeth, borderline everything. And to be fair, I mean, it was one of the funnest times in the industry for me because we were such a small, close-knit group of people dealing with people who probably nowadays you wouldn't go there. You know, it was a risky business. People were very passionate and very angry. But what I did love about it was the opportunity to watch in real time, well, not real time, but, you know, watch crafted watching, two people have an argument and then have to come together, two sides have an argument, have to come together and somehow still live next door to each other with a little help from our friends and our mediators and all the rest of it. Look, it kind of got to the point, I think, that we had to put it to bed because we weren't getting both sides anymore. And that felt really different. You know, unless you have both sides, it's different. And that's not about balance. That's about perspectives. And actually it being less of a, it's not a whinge or a rant or an angry kind of, I don't know, culture war. It's just both sides of the story. And that's what I loved. I don't know what you think, but that's what I loved about it is you would listen to one side and go, oh yeah, those neighbours are absolute assholes. And then you'd listen to the other side and go, yeah, but so are they. And it just, that's what I loved about it. It wasn't about balance. It was just about perspective.
100%.
That's the purity of it. And then, of course, you had the brilliant voiceovers written by Bill Curtin and Lee Baker, which just lifted it to the next level of humour but not making fun of people. And the fact that those two directed it as well, and the fact that they were able to direct the people doing their own reconstructions is just genius. It's just genius.
I completely agree, because I think that was that, and that kind of goes to the element of me mentioning it could have been risky, because I felt like I've seen some, because I've read back on some of the feedback from it, and I never felt like Neighbours at War was actually punching down. If anything, I think it kind of gave a light-sided humour to kind of the ridiculousness of sometimes like Neighbours like having these trifles and having these problems, when in reality they were quite ridiculous. And like you said, getting both sides of the story really, yeah, gave perspective, because you're like, yeah, they're both just terrible people and they just need to have a chat and sit down and it'll be fine. And the mediation was sometimes actually the best part of it. It wasn't actually the drama, it was the mediation, them realizing, oh, we're both terrible, like, let's shake hands and have a hug and whatnot. And I think that was the gold of it.
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, it's so funny because I think when it's your neighbour, I mean, we had something similar, Dan and I, with one of our neighbours, not to the Neighbours at War extent, but when it's right next to you, it's really hard to see the wood for the trees, and you do become obsessive, you know, and you do feel like you've become a different type of person than you would normally be because it's so close to you. It's like literally with you every day. And I think when we would go out, so my researcher, Nicole and I would go out and meet these people, and we knew they were good people, most of them. You know, we'd sit down in the lounges and have cups of tea and talk about their, you know, what their issues were and get all the research together before the director went out there. But we would come away going, these guys are fine. They're not unhinged. They're totally normal people, but they just shouldn't be living next to each other right now. Yeah, for whatever reason that was. Yeah. No, and it was a challenge, that one, but one that I look back on and go, phew, don't want to do that again, but it was really cool.
Because I think it's, like you said, it's the most human story ever. People are going to have barmies with their neighbours, and yeah, I think you totally hit the nail on the head as well. The obsessiveness, I definitely know my family had some pretty terrible neighbours over the years, and I think for the same record, they probably thought we were terrible as well, which is fair game. Admittedly, I had a drum kit and played it like probably stupidly loud all the time, and so people probably hated me. Yeah, exactly. You know, it's just what you do. The neighbours love it. But it's cool that you've been a part of so many other like incredible factual programs, including, as I said earlier in the intro, Motorway Patrol, The Zoo. For you, what is it for you that really kind of encapsulates factual TV, and what does it mean for you to be able to show New Zealand voices and New Zealand faces to the public? Like, does it have something special in your heart? Do you feel like it's something you think about?
Yep, all the time. I mean, it look, I wouldn't still be doing this if I didn't think it was super important. And I think now that we've sort of reached peak disruption, whatever you want to call it, peak, you know, the whole fragmentation of platforms and all the rest of it, I think the only thing that is going to resonate with us across the generations is when we actually do not necessarily come together, but we watch ourselves on screen as Aotearoa, as New Zealanders, because we've got so much choice of so much international great stuff, but it's not the same. And I think in the factual unscripted space, just we're so different to everyone else around the world. And I mean, people love us around the world. I mean, Greenstone shows, like you mentioned, Motorway Patrol, Border Patrol, you know, all of those shows sell internationally like crazy. Like they sell to over 30 countries, Nat Geo in the States, all sorts of places, because they actually love the kaupapa of New Zealand and New Zealanders. You know, they love our humour. They love the fact that our cops are good guys generally, you know, or good people generally. They love that, you know, we speak to people. We don't just get our guns out, you know, and it's all of the korero, the kaupapa, all of that stuff. It's so uniquely us that we have to keep making content that's uniquely us. Yes, we can make stuff with international money and we can sometimes, you know, veer off that. But I think in terms of the factual space, we have to keep making our stories and our voices. It's more our voices than our stories. Our stories need to be captured, but it's our voice and how we tell those stories that's super important as well, I think. So that's why I'm keeping going, even though I'm an old lady now. I just think it's super, super important. It doesn't matter which platform you're across, but I do, my other plea, I guess, is we need to use our own platforms, otherwise we're going to lose our own platforms. And I think it's really difficult these days. And I mean, obviously I've got three 20-something kids and I'm aware of how much they watch on YouTube and all the rest of it. And we all do. I mean, we all do it. We scroll like crazy every day. But I feel like use it or lose it. And our platforms are trying really hard to survive. And they've got some really good content on them. You know, TVNZ Plus, 3 Now, Sky Open, Whakaata Māori, they're all free. So, and that's where we have to, if we're funding something, have a New Zealand platform. So we should watch it on those platforms. That's my little rant for the day. But because we will lose them, it's just unfortunate that the advertisers are going and across to the others, thinking there's more eyeballs. But actually, if we bring the eyeballs back, they'll come back. And then we'll have more money in the pot. And then we can make more. So, yeah.
Do you worry about the Americanization of New Zealand television in that sense? Because, yeah, I've noticed that's always kind of been a problem for New Zealanders, that they always make the comparison. I've spoken to people who are musicians, people that work in the radio industry, and they have this expectation, oh, it's cool. It's pretty good for New Zealand. Do you feel that's still kind of a phrase that stays true, is that there's always this comparison to the bigger country, the UK, America, the US, even from the platform perspective? Do you think that's kind of a big problem that we still need to overcome as we still compare ourselves to our bigger neighbours?
I think a little bit sometimes, and it's mainly around budget, right? But what I have noticed with the FANGs, and that's, you know what FANGs are, eh? Yeah. Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, Google, Spotify. There's obviously more as well. But with those FANGs, I think it's really interesting because there is a homogenous look to a lot of their factual programming now, that not so much in the drama space. They're doing some amazing, inventive, fantastic stuff. I mean, look at Adolescence, look at The Bear, even Only Murders in the Building. It's brilliant. It's so brilliant. But I do think in the factual space, sometimes there's some great stuff, but sometimes it can get really lazy and it all looks the same and you've got your straight down the barrel interviews with the set in the background. And, you know, I think New Zealand and New Zealand factual makers are brilliant in the sense that they can do stuff, amazing stuff, with very little. You know, the Obstock style, I think we can take risks because we have to. We're not being dictated to by these big streaming platforms who want to look. So I guess it's a little bit of both. There's still a little bit of that cringe factor. But I don't know, I think we should be proud of what we're making, because I actually think for the budgets we make it on, it's incredible. And same goes for scripted as well. We do incredible stuff. I mean, look at After the Party, Happiness, You know, we've just made our series Don't. I don't know whether you probably haven't been able to look at it over there, but that was a crazy new factual genre, which we are now calling comedy with a lot of facts, because it started off as a factual series with comedians, but then the comedians pretty much took it over, which I love and why it works. It's perfect. But, you know, this crazy ad-lib, pseudo-scripted kind of journey that then we put real people vox pops in and also sit down interviews, but it works. But no streamer on the planet would have supported that. Thank you, TVNZ. You know, you could not have described it to anyone, any international, but it's really great. And we're hoping that that will then translate, and the format can obviously work for different countries around the world, depending on their comedians and that style. So we wouldn't have made that if we were making it for a Netflix. I think
that's something interesting as well, going back to what you said earlier about the fact that advertisers are leaving in droves of the New Zealand platforms or the local platforms, which does not make any sense to me, considering you want to be hitting a local audience, and by segmenting yourself into these other platforms that ultimately you're going to have to be paying probably four times the price to even get even a spot. Does it kind of frustrate you a little bit that, like, people are missing out on what is essentially going to be the most engaged audience that they can have, compared to, I'm guessing, the general public that are watching Netflix and stuff are probably doing something on their phone, whereas if someone's watching a New Zealand show, I feel like they're probably giving it a lot more attention because they know it's going to be something that they can see in their backyard.
Yeah, and also it's who you're trying to speak to, right? You want them to buy your products, whereas YouTube is the wild, wild, you know, it's like out of space. You don't know who you're going to be talking to. I know you can slightly, you know, niche it, but I feel like it's so much more targeted. Like you said, and I think I'm hoping that they'll come round. I had this little dream where we could put out a campaign to get them back to the platforms and make them realize, those brands realize, that actually this is your audience and they are sitting down. And, you know, I know within our family, and we may be unusual, we are quite unusual, but you know, we will sit down as a family of younger adults, you know, and old people, and we will watch the same show together if it goes out live on TVNZ Plus or on Neon or whatever, Sky Open. And then we'll have a conversation about it. But we also sit down and watch the ads, bizarrely enough, because it feels like a different world. Yeah. Oh, they're advertising there. Oh, that's cool. So it's almost like the ads. If you have an ad on you know, free-to-air TV, you've actually got an audience, because everyone's going, oh, wow, that's unusual. So I don't know. I feel like, I think people might come back. I think the brands might come back. I know there's a lot of branded content. I'm not sure that's the answer, I think. But aligning with a show that you think people will be watching is still important, right? It's targeted. And advertising across other platforms isn't targeted at all. Yeah.
I wanted to touch on something you just said as well. You said that it's sometimes you sit through the ads. I'm not going to lie, that's something I've done recently, because I was like, I miss this. Like, don't get me wrong, I will skip ads if I'm watching anything on bloody YouTube or, I don't know, Amazon or anything. Yeah. But, like, if it's free to air, I actually pay attention. I have no idea why. But, yeah, when you obviously have the option to forward through them. And I was just like, no, I'll let this sit. I'll let this cook, you know. Let's see what they got.
Yeah, I agree. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's that there's a sound bar and they sound better on the actual TV. But also, I think it is, it's kind of like, oh, it's like the old days, or just people are buying more insurance from this person. You know, I just think it has cut through. It's bizarre to say that, but I do think ads have more cut through these days on free to air. Yeah, that's so funny that you do too. I'm not the only weirdo.
Oh, no, there's plenty of weirdos, trust me, Tash. And I think one thing that I think would have been weird to do, and it's kind of touches on something you said about how, like, the documentaries have become a bit cookie cutter on a lot of those major platforms, because they do have a style of format, and yeah, obviously they make them as cheaply as possible because they want to churn them out as quickly as they can. And how do you think that would have changed, like, documentaries like the ones that you released, such as obviously the woman of Pike River? Do you feel like no one else would have been able to do it justice compared to a local TV production? Like, is it scary that there may be a potential, if like production companies such as Greenstone don't exist, that is how they're going to be handled? Is cookie cutter someone who doesn't really care about the subject and they're just making another documentary?
I mean, I think there's a danger of that, but I don't think it will happen. And that's mainly because going back to that trust thing. So the women in Pike River would never have happened if we hadn't spent as much time as we did with those families, talking, and we wouldn't have got what we got from them without that huge amount of lead up period and building that trust and doing our research. And, you know, Mary, who directed that, and Alex Reed and I, we're still in constant contact with all of those women. And same with a lot of the other shows that we've made. You know, The Big Ward, which was the obesity series, which nobody had done one of those before. It was very much fly on the wall, obstocky. Still in contact with most of those people. And it's just because you form it, it's like they become part of your whānau. And because they trust what you've made on their behalf, or, you know, the way you've represented them, you can do that. I think that's the trouble with the cookie cutter, is you don't you're not allowed the time to do that. And really, my gut feeling is, what's the point? And I think that shines through in the actual production or content as well. I think we are all at a stage where we're all a bit sick of non-authentic content, whatever, whether that's music or whatever it is. And I think that that authenticity piece, and I know that's kind of a catchphrase, but it's the humanity and the authenticity that makes a project connect with people. And I just don't think that cookie cutter, I mean, yes, we'll consume it if we're sitting on the couch and we're knackered, or we're on the plane and we're bored, but we won't necessarily connect with it. And look, if we're making unscripted, we want to connect with people. That's the whole point. I know for some of the streamers, it's about making money and churning things in cookie cutter stuff. But actually, for people who actually want to make unscripted and want to make a difference, it has to connect, because what's the point if you don't connect with people? And it, you know, it can be a niche group of people that you're trying to connect with. It can be multi-generational, can be whatever, but that connection is key. And I just don't think cookie cutter can connect. It's consumed, but it doesn't connect, is my gut feeling. But I'm a little bit biased, Jamie.
No. It's great, because I think one of the other things that I'd be interested to know about is, do you feel like that can sometimes in itself be a challenge, because you do become so emotionally invested in the subjects that maybe necessarily you worry about how you're telling the story? Is there ever elements, for example, let's take the river, the woman at Pike River, does it ever get concerning to the point that you're like, I feel like I'm too close to the subject now, so I don't know how I can tell the story without it feeling like I'm touching a nerve, but in the same respect, you're wanting to tell the story so people understand the gravity of it? Is there ever that sort of challenge or consequence as a part of like having these deep connections?
I think they can be, but again, I think it's about the team that you've got around you. So I think that part of my role as an EP and as a producer back in the day as well, is about taking a step back. So forming those relationships, letting the creative part go, and then coming back in with very much a viewer perspective, because it is about who's viewing it as much as it is about the people in it. So that's a balance, obviously. I think it's knowing that you have the support around you, that if something feels like it's going down that kind of rabbit hole, you can pull the handbrake on and go, hang on. And I mean, I think that's the beauty with documentary, is that it's not decided at the front. It's a bit of it is decided at the front, but literally you are creating the documentary when you have everything. And depending on your budget, you can always go back and get different things or change it up. You know what I mean? And we at Greenstone, we have a co-puffer, and lots of people, lots of doco makers do, where we will always show our contributors the doco or the series prior to it going on any platform, because that's the very least you could do. Out of, you know, they may have signed their lives away on consent forms and things, but they have to be happy, and you have to be happy knowing that they're happy. And I think that's, again, knowing that that's coming at the end of the day, and that you're going to have to front up, helps keep you grounded and keep you on the right track and not going off on tangents or getting too close or whatever. But actually, yeah, just reflecting on that, it is about the contributors and their stories and their perspectives, but it is also about who you're talking to and who's going to be viewing it. And that is a yin-yang thing that I think is really important, because it keeps it, I'm not going to use the word balance, that's not the word, but it keeps it okay. You know, yeah.
Have you ever sat in the edit suite with someone, or in the respect of, obviously you talk about the subjects and the people, has there ever been kind of like a moment where you worry, you're looking at the subjects and being like, oh, are they okay with this? Like, how do we go through it? Has there been reactions that you didn't expect, perhaps? Or generally, most people, because of the way that you guys handle stuff and because you're so closely knit, you've never had an issue where someone's been like, I feel like I've been misrepresented, or I don't feel like the story's been told in the right way, or... is it something that kind of does happen, but very rarely?
I feel really lucky, but I don't think I've ever. Actually, this is not true. There has been one case, and it wasn't a big doco. It was a series that we were making called Serious Crash Unit, where we were following the police and sort of reconstructing what had happened prior to a serious crash. It was pretty traumatizing. It was an amazing show. It's not something that I would ever want to do again. I still have trauma when I'm driving on the motorways, because I've seen a lot of footage I possibly should never have seen. But actually, that was a moment in time where we would, out of respect for the families who had been involved in it, have to go and sit in their living rooms and view it with them. And I do remember there was a particular gnarly crash which involved a young teenager who ended up in a wheelchair, and we were watching it with her entire family, and I just sat there and went, this is terrible, because the older brother was so angry at her. She'd got into the car with a drunk. I mean, you know, it was just like, that was a moment where I went, oh, I didn't see this coming, and I really wish I had. That was pretty traumatizing. But then in most of the other cases, I think we've got such a good sense of the story and the people and the trust is there that we haven't really had anything like that. It's pretty much been done really well. I mean, there's always challenges. I mean, we made a doco called Unmasking the Monsters for TVNZ last year, where we were following the customs officers within New Zealand Customs, the team that deal with child exploitation, online exploitation, which is pretty gnarly. It's not everybody's cup of tea in terms of subject. And we weren't obviously touching on the content per se, but we were following them and their work. And that was really hard to step through. That was really sensitive material, and they were putting themselves on the line. It's not a job that everyone can do. But I think because we had producers and the team were so experienced and so trusted by those customs officers, we were allowed in, and it was all fine, you know. But yeah, of course, you have a moment in each production where you go, whoa. But generally, because of what you've done up front with the research and stuff and the trust building, you'll be okay in the end. But that's why that front end is so important.
Makes so much sense. And it makes even more sense why Brainstone has been around for more than 30 years. And do you think this is something that, like, maybe you have access to a lot more things that other production companies wouldn't have? And if there was a dream area that you feel Greenstone would ideally like to go down, is there like unexplored territory that you feel Greenstone would potentially want to do in the future? Is there a subject matter that you guys have been kind of keeping in the pipeline, or is that something you can't share, Taj, because I'm sure maybe another production company might be listening in?
I couldn't possibly share that because I'd have to kill you.
Yeah.
No, I think what I would say is I've been at Greenstone not the whole time, but for quite a long time now. And I think we just want to do more, and we just want to tell more stories. I mean, I think that it's very hard these days to predict what people are going to be consuming and wanting to watch. So I think maintaining a really good attitude around, if it's a good story or if you've got this amazing access, let's build on that and see what comes of it, you know. And so I guess we do a lot of development of ideas that just don't actually go anywhere. But we never put them away. They just go in the top drawer. They don't go in the bottom drawer. They just stay there because there's always a time for something. So I think the thing that we do really well at Greenstone is we all just go, never put anything away. If you feel like in the first instance it's been worth developing, keep it simmering, because at some point it will turn into something. We don't quite know what it'll be, but it will turn into something. And I love, at the moment, I guess what I would love to do more of is that mashup of genre a little bit. I think we tried that on Don't and it worked really, really well. And it's not that you want to force that, but I think that's what I'm loving about Only Murders in the Building as well. The fourth season is the podcast, film, screen world is just all mashing up and it's really working for me. And maybe that's because our attention spans are shorter or I don't know, but I think that would be cool fun, I think, to try some more stuff that's a little bit scripted, a little bit factual, not, you know, because I think viewers are really open to that now, much more than they used to be. We're not as trad, and I think that would be fun to try that more. Yeah, that's probably it. Just keep doing it. I just want to keep doing it, Jamie. I just hope nobody kicks me out, because I've only got one plan B if they kick me out of the building, and that's I'll have to become a border officer. At the airport.
Because
all the years of watching how to deal with people and stuff, I think I could do that job really well.
So I think one of the more important things to mention about Greenstone as well is that you're one of six women that work in Greenstone, and that is a very unusual thing for TV production, especially because, and maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but traditionally media is a bit of a boys' club. Is it quite warming in a sense that you're working in a company where it is female-led, and do you feel like there is a big difference in terms of not only the way that you guys approach your projects, but also how you work as a team together, because there's a lot more of a different kind of dynamic compared to maybe other production companies?
Yep, 100%. And it's really interesting because it kind of just evolved. It's not something that, you know, we woke up and went, right, we're only employing women on our leadership team. But the funny thing is as it kind of, we brought the leadership team together, and obviously Rachel Antony's the CEO and she's incredible and she attracts really amazing women to her. But as it grew, we were just kind of like, oh yeah, you're awesome. You're the best person for this job. You know, it's totally just evolved like that. But what's cool about it is that, yes, we just get the job done. You know, there's no egos in that room. And I mean, it's partly the personalities of the people as well. It's not just gender based, but it really is, if something's going down, it's everyone's in to help. It's the collaboration aspect of it, and nobody's really trying to, I think we've all done it for long enough too that we're not about trying to prove anything. So that's helpful too. And funnily enough, our head of scripted, Harriet, she also grew up with me in Bats Theatre. So there, and Rachel also was a musical theatre baby. So maybe there's something about, you know, theatre and that co-op thing that we're full circle on, that we just jump in and do it. What I'm really proud of the leadership team though is that we've got seven now. Philippa Rennie has just joined us, and it's partly we're forging the way. We're prepared to take risks. We don't just have to do things the same way. And you know, lots of us are trying to upskill on the whole international jigsaw piece. The legals around that are immense. The business end of that is immense. But we're all just stepping through it and helping each other with it, and we're actually really good at it now. So I'm not. I'm a newbie. There's a lot for me to learn. But the rest of the team are incredible, and the sort of finance legal end of it is massive nowadays, and they're all great. So look, we have fun as well. That's a big part of it too. You know, we have the, you know, one of our Beck who works with us, he cuts out the little quiz from the Herald every day, and then on a Friday we all get together and we have a drink, just, you know, in the office, and we read out the quiz. I mean, it's so old school and silly, but it actually makes a difference, being together in an office. By the same token, if people need to work from home because it's school holidays or people are sick or whatever, fine too. I mean, I just think it's that flexibility, but also looking after each other. And that sounds a bit waffly, but it works. It works for us. I couldn't work anywhere else at the moment, I don't think, quite frankly. But
yeah, that's you what guys I said. Have set the a good airport. Tone. Yeah, you've set a good tone for working in the office and working as a collaborative team. And I think that's the thing I find interesting, because I saw in an interview that you once talked about how you've been making shows for a third of the cost with no significant New Zealand on your funding. How do you guys keep delivering such high quality content considering budget constraints are so tight? And how, Tash, how do you guys do it?
I think it's because there's been years and lots of effort put into relationships with distributors. So really good distribution internationally is really important, because that helps the cash flow back into the company. So if you can sell your IP, whether that's a format or the made show, that's huge, because that is allowing you to keep the teams on board. You know, you're not sending people away and trying to get the same skilled people back. You're maintaining, you know, there's gnarly times where that's not easy, and definitely now is a gnarly time for everybody. But that's why maintaining the IP on the shows that we make is so crucial, because without that, you've got nothing really. And I think that's where the streamers trying to suck everything up and taking that IP, you may be in the money for a short period of time, but that has no long tail to it. And I think that's where Greenstone's model has been really good. And there's been a certain amount of luck, but the relationships, the international distribution, the trust that's been built with some of those big international platforms, Acorn with My Life is Murder, and, you know, Border Patrol, Nat Geo, can't get enough of it. You know, we're lucky, because Greenstone's had that huge back catalogue for a long time. I sound like a cracked record, but trust. It's trust that we will deliver what we've said we'll deliver. It is getting harder because, as you mentioned, the funding pool here in New Zealand and Aotearoa is just, it's tiny. And so all credit to anybody who can make anything at the moment, because it's really hard. It's really hard. And I know a lot of people are making stuff completely off their own bat. I mean, Katie Wolfe, who made the Haka Party instant, that was her and Tim just, you know, needing to do it. But we shouldn't have to do that. We should have a proper funding pool. But that's okay. Maybe it'll change. I don't know. I live in hope. I always live in hope. That somebody's going to turn up with a massive wallet and go, look, you guys make great content. Here's some money.
Actually, that's something that I want to really touch on, because this is the thing. Yeah, you talk about Border Patrol, very sellable. Is there ever like a situation where you guys worry about making content from a Māori perspective or tikanga, or from a Pacific perspective, that maybe an American distributor is like, oh, we're cool with this, but we want to repackage it in another way that maybe doesn't represent the culture in a certain way. Is that ever a concern for you guys, or are you always sticking to your guns? You're like, if you're going to buy this, if you're going to purchase it, so you have to stick to what we have. You cannot repurpose this in a way that's not representative of the culture or our people.
Yeah, no, we're very strict on that. As absolutely, I mean, we haven't had a lot, but obviously, working with government agencies, it's really they trust us that things aren't going to be recut and recalibrated out of context. And basically, yeah, no way, no. I mean, if you want our stuff, you want it because it's what it is, not going to be, you know, sliced and diced in a different way to suit a different, you know. It doesn't mean that if you're going up front for money in the early stages, you wouldn't try to incorporate something as part of the package, but that would probably undergo quite a robust discussion, I think, beforehand. But yeah, nah, it's your IP, and if anyone wants to mess with that, it's not worth it. It's not worth it, especially with the factual stuff, you know, but even scripted, I think you have to maintain a certain level of, autonomy. And we definitely do that at Greenstone. So for better or worse, but we do.
And you talk about the struggles as well, but you've mentioned in a previous interview as well that sometimes just being able to laugh things off is really how you can get through the day. Do you still stand by that statement that, like, even though TV can be a bit of a fickle beast, it can be stressful as hell, like, you just have to have a good sense of humor and be able to laugh? Is that something you still stand by and still live by today?
Oh my God, my poor neighboring colleagues, they get so sick of me sometimes. They're like, Tash, shut up. Or, you know, just stop with that conversation. But absolutely, I mean, it's super important. I mean, we're dealing with people. It's people. And people need to be happy is the wrong word. But, you know, it's not, we're not saving lives. We are creating stories, and you just can't get too serious. I mean, they are serious topics, believe me, but you have to keep yourself healthy and happy to be able to tell those on somebody's behalf. And I just think it's not worth it otherwise. Why, you know, we are so lucky doing what we do. It's one of the best jobs in the entire world. I feel very privileged. I feel very lucky. So, hey, may as well enjoy it. And that's not flippant at all. It is just making sure that we realize it's not about us, but it is about us being able to do things properly and on behalf of somebody. And if you're not in a good space, then the project's not going to be in a good space. Although, to be fair, I have my fair amount of rants and the occasional tear. So it's not all happy days, but it's keeping things into perspective, I think. Yeah, it's a creative art and it's about storytelling. You can't tell those stories if you make it about you and you're too serious. Yeah. And Dan would disagree with me.
Yeah, Dan would disagree with you. And I have to ask, because you once said the winning combo is cheese sauce on veg. Now, when it comes to TV production and like kind of maintaining the mix of creativity and production reality, what is the winning combo for you if you're going to put together like not only just a team but like a winning production? What are the key elements that you need to make that cheese sauce on veg combo?
I think it's being open-minded to what's going to come out of that story and not fixating on what you want to say and how it should be done. Absolutely have parameters, but allow the space for some humor, for some unexpected moments, for the relatable moments. I mean, the cheese sauce on the veggies is pretty much about our obs dogs, which is, you know, motorway patrol classic. You know, you're giving people road safety messaging for 30 minutes. Like, who would really sit down and watch 30 minutes of road safety messaging? But because of the way they're cut, because of the clever teams that make it, it's fun and it's entertaining. I mean, we call it edutainment, which is kind of a long-winded word, but it is. I mean, and people feel good if they've come away and they've learned something. You know, we all feel good about that. We feel better about ourselves. We feel better about the world. So if we can make something that people have, A, loved, laughed at is good, if you can, but also come away feeling like they are more knowledgeable and they understand something better than they ever did, hey, job done, basically, I think, especially in the factual world. Different scripted, but I think factual, that's the key. Yeah.
Your kids following in suit, because we talk about yourself and your husband both working in television production, and both of your sons are in bands, one being Daffodils, which I checked out before coming on to have a chat with you. Is it just something that runs in the family, both the creativity, but two, do you think your kids are going to join in on the whole TV production, or have they've been like, nope, we've seen mum and dad, we're never going to do this, it's too stressful?
I really expected to at least get one kid who was like rebelling and going, yeah, I don't want to be creative. But we've failed. We've created three of the most brilliant creative kids you could possibly have. I'm like, oh, really? So I have, yeah, musicians, professional musician, professional writer. Ooh, nice. And then Barney, our youngest, is in Wellington doing screen arts. So, you know, They do, don't believe me, we don't have like sort of, we definitely have conversations where they're rolling their eyes going, oh, shut up about the cutaways. And can you just shush about the music? And, you know, so I think they could easily have gone away from that. But in some ways it's really good because we all understand each other and we understand the highs and lows. And, Yeah, we talk about stuff a lot in our house. I currently have the two oldest ones living with us again, because of course, when you are a creative, it's quite hard to afford life. So, but again, that's fun, right? It's good because it means we're all talking, and it goes back to the cordero and the conversation. And I think if we're open to stuff, it's good, you know, and they have different viewpoints, believe me. We've had some robust discussions in our house recently, but it's good. It's good.
And this is where I usually come to the final call, Taj, which is going through, obviously you've had a fantastic career, and for a lot of people, it can be scary entering an industry where it seems unreliable. There's a lot of things going on. You talk about the funding cuts, but you've obviously stayed in this industry. You've said that you can't imagine yourself anywhere else. For anyone who's entering into the industry now, what would be your advice to them, especially if they're wanting to get into television production? What do you think are the key steps, or what are the key things that people need? You mentioned ego. You mentioned that's something you need to be in check, not be a dick. But what do you think are the key things now for anyone who's a young person looking at studying or getting into the industry?
I think I would say we need you. We absolutely need you. We need creative people to keep doing what they're doing. AI cannot take over. I refuse to let that happen. And it won't. I don't think it will in the creative spaces as much as we think it might. There's going to be some gnarly times with it, but I think we need people, and we need people who are passionate. Again, sorry to use that word, but we do need people who are passionate, who are committed to doing some hard mahi, and knowing that there's not going to be much money in it, and definitely there's not much glory in it, but you want to tell those stories because you really give a shit. And that's important, and that's why you should be doing it. You shouldn't – look, depending on which area you're going into, but if I'm just talking about factual and doco, I would say you need to want to do it. Don't do it for any other reason apart from the fact that you feel driven to – A, you love people, because you have to love people. You also have to be quite confident to be able to relay that confidence to those people that you're dealing with. You have to be able to build that trust factor. But it's not going to be easy. And I think we are going through a perfect storm right now. So I would say stick with it if you can. If you have to get another job, just do it. Other jobs are great. I mean, whether you're driving a van or working in a supermarket or whatever, that's where you interact with people. And that's where you can build your skills, like I did on the telephone, talking to crazy Americans. But, you know, those, whatever you do in life, if you're working in doco or factual, that will help your work in the long run, because you are being part of your viewership. And that's how you relate, and that's how you're going to know how to create content that people want to watch, because you are with people. I mean, you know, hey tangata, hey tangata, hey tangata. It's all it's about. It literally is about people. And so don't despair. If you get a gig and then you don't get one for a year or so, what's so cool about technology now is you can do your own stuff anyway. It doesn't cost you anything. I mean, just keep doing it. If you want to do it, do it. And don't let the world put you off, because we need you. We need you. We need the next gen to keep telling our stories.
If you like the podcast, I'd love for you to leave a 5-star review on your preferred podcast platform and let me know your thoughts on the show. Don't forget, you can reach out to me via Instagram at beyondbroadcastpod or via email at beyondbroadcastpod@gmail.com. Until next time, take it easy.